You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert. Every 2 years, about 20,000 people from organizations around the world working on issues surrounding HIV and AIDS convene in one place for the International AIDS Conference. In the year 2020, that conference is currently slated to take place right here, San Francisco. And that plan has become a source of major controversy because a number of grassroots groups working on HIV issues think that holding the conference in an obscenely expensive city inside a country with increasingly aggressive restrictions on visas is going to keep a lot of people out of the conference who should probably be right at the center of it. So we're going to talk travel, we're going to talk immigration, and we're going to talk HIV policy. We have two guests. George Ayala is the executive director of MPACT, Global Action for Gay Men's Health and Rights. Nana Khanna is executive director of Positive Women's Network. Thank you both of you for coming in.
Thanks for having us, Brian.
Thank you.
Let's start with basics. Explain what the Global AIDS Conference is. Where did it come from? What does it do?
Well, the Global AIDS Conference is an opportunity for a cross-section of communities that are working in the HIV response globally to come together to share information, to share new science, to deliberate research, and really to advocate, to speak truth to power, which is represented at these conferences. They happen every 2 years. They draw, I know, anywhere between 10 and 15,000, maybe 20,000 people, depending on where they happen. Over the years, they've grown. They've grown in size, but also in cost. They're multi-million dollar operations. And our organization actually was born out of an international AIDS conference back in 2006.
Born out in what sense?
Well, a group of activists from around the world were really quite concerned about the toll that HIV was taking on gay and bisexual men worldwide, and the relative silence at the time about that fact. We started to put together pre-conference activities, events, as a way to shine a spotlight on the issue. And the conference served as a really important platform for that. And the same group of men who started to organize those activities formed themselves as what was the Global Forum on MSM and HIV, and now is MPACT, Global Action for Gay Men's Health and Rights.
So who are the people that you're working with now that you would not be working with were it not for the convening power of this conference?
I think the convening power of the conference puts us in direct conversation with researchers, which is really the principal constituency that the conference serves. It also gives us an opportunity to do coalition work with women's rights and women's global health movements, with movements of sex workers and people who use drugs, who are also disproportionately impacted by HIV around the world. So the conference gives us a very interesting opportunity to put together a cross-section of people. And it doesn't happen very often. It happens in other venues, but not very often.
Okay, so now the conference is slated to be in your backyard across the bay in San Francisco. You can go for the price of a BART ticket. What's the problem with that?
Well, I mean, you know, just what George was sharing, I think what we see is that this conference has historically been a really important gathering space for civil society groups to come together, to coalesce around agendas, to work across intersectional movements. And it's also a place where usually the part of the priority is to uplift a political agenda, right? So civil society, you know, to understand why the conference coming to the Bay Area is a problem, it's important to understand who's most impacted by HIV in the U.S. and globally. And so we're primarily looking at low-income folks, people from low-income countries. Within the U.S. context, we're looking at low-income people who are living with HIV. We're looking at men who have sex with men, mostly Black and Latinx in the U.S. context. We're looking at folks of trans experience. We're looking at people who use drugs, sex workers, all of whom have an important role to play in the domestic and global HIV response. And so having the U.S. Host a conference in the context of a very hostile political climate where actually currently people who use drugs, sex workers, are actually barred from entering the United States right now. It's not possible for them to get visas.
Explain how that works, because a lot of people just get visas by flying into an airport. So this is people from countries that have to apply for a visa ahead of time answer questions about these issues?
So, you know, immigration to the U.S. has never been easy, despite what some of the media might tell you. And certainly for folks from many of the countries that are disproportionately impacted by the epidemic, there is a requirement to get visas well in advance before arriving in order to enter. And so historically, we have at one point had a travel ban on people living with HIV, actually, which was lifted by President Obama and is the reason that the global community was open to the conference returning here in 2012. So the conference was held in Washington, D.C. in 2012. At that time, Positive Women's Network, which I represent, was actually one of the host organizations for that conference. But at that time, there remained challenges to sex workers and people who use drugs entering the United States. And so, as a result, sex workers actually hosted an alternate conference in Calcutta, India, during the U.S. International AIDS Conference. Today in 2020, the travel restrictions are so much worse. We have a travel ban on multiple Muslim countries. We have people from various Latin American countries having to leave, you know, losing temporary protected status. It's just a much more hostile political climate. We also recently had an activist from the Philippines, Jerome Eba, who was detained at San Francisco Airport, even though he actually had a visa to enter. And so we have a lot of concern about the risk actually posed by hosting a conference in a hostile country to the communities most impacted by the epidemic. And frankly, you know, this conference is 2 years away. We don't know what additional types of restrictions might be coming.
Just to underscore a couple of points that Nana was making, it is really very difficult to get a visa to enter the U.S., especially from places like Sub-Saharan Africa and Middle East, Central Asia, Eastern Europe. Sub-Saharan Africa is really the place where HIV is hitting the hardest. And it really doesn't make sense in my mind to continue to situate an international AIDS conference in the global north when we know the lion's share of HIV burden resides in the global south. And as an example, many members of our communities will have to go out of country to embassies, U.S. embassies, to secure visa applications. And the wait list is often 3-6 months ahead of time. So it's very, very difficult. It's very expensive for folks to do that. So just to underscore this point, it's going to make it really very difficult for members of our community from the Global South to enter the U.S. I'd also add that given that sex workers and people who use drugs and men who have sex with men and trans people contribute to about 45% of all new HIV infections around the world, it doesn't make sense for us to hold an international conference where great swaths of those communities can't even get to the event.
I would just reframe contribute to comprise 45% of the epidemic globally. This is also not an abstract issue. In March, the Commission on the Status of Women was hosted by the United Nations in New York. This is a global human rights event where women's rights and feminist advocates from all over the world come together. And multiple women from African countries were denied visas to enter the U.S. because they could not prove they needed to have bank accounts. I mean, this actually had nothing to do with HIV status or being a sex worker or a person who uses drugs. This was just simply not being able to prove that they had a bank account. So they couldn't show that they wouldn't become public charge, which is actually one of the pending policies that we know might be coming out from this administration, is a determination that anybody can be denied entry and potentially deported or fined if they are an immigrant and determined to potentially become a burden, a quote, burden on U.S. society. So this is absolutely not an abstract issue. It's already happening.
What about the rule that Barack Obama reversed barring entry by people with HIV? Is that something that it's within the power of the executive branch to reinstate under Donald Trump?
I think
it
absolutely
is. Yes, it certainly is. And, you know, the administration has not substantially turned their attention to HIV yet. It's not outside of the realm of possibility that that travel ban could be reinstated.
We're speaking to Nana Khanna. She's executive director of Positive Women's Network, and George Ayala, executive director of MPACT, Global Action for Gay Men's Health and Rights. And the proximate topic of our conversation is the upcoming International AIDS Conference, which is slated to take place in San Francisco in 2020, and the controversy over holding it here. under the aegis of the Trump administration. Now, there are a substantial number of organizations involved with the conference who still want to hold it in San Francisco. They have several arguments, the most salient of which is it takes a whole lot of infrastructure and institutional capacity to organize a conference for 20,000 people, and when they shopped it around to poorer countries, they didn't get any bids or takers. What's your response to that?
Well, I'll speak from the domestic side, and perhaps George can speak a little bit from the global side. So the Bay Area is actually one of the most expensive cities in the U.S. to host a conference. So that's sort of a ridiculous argument in many different ways. It's not only expensive for the organizers, it's absolutely out of reach for most of the people, even within the U.S., most impacted by the epidemic. So our epidemic here in the United States is primarily in the U.S. South, and primarily impacting low-income people who are not going to be able to afford to come to the Bay Area to attend a conference. So, you know, let alone the cost of traveling across the country, let's just talk about a few barriers. Number one, it's almost impossible to find affordable places to stay in the Bay Area, right? So this is a five-day conference. Folks are going to need, you know, multiple nights of hotels. Where are 20,000 people going to stay in the Bay Area, especially people who are lower income and organizations that don't have high budgets that are trying to send folks to this conference? Number two, it's not even safe for immigrants in the U.S. right now to really move around the U.S. So that's another issue. Why put the conference on a coast that's sort of so inaccessible for many different people? Having it in, you know, there are other places, like in the U.S. South, where the conference could potentially be hosted that would be more accessible, more affordable, more centered in the communities most impacted by this epidemic.
I suppose from a global perspective, there's a question about whether we need such big and expensive conferences. And certainly, I don't think Nana and I are arguing against the value of bringing people together to deliberate science and to exchange information and to elevate an advocacy agenda worldwide. There's also certainly value in putting advocates together and researchers together in a conversation about how we advance the global response to HIV. But we have to ask ourselves, you know, in 2018 and 2020, do we really need conferences this big, especially in light of the fact that, you know, there are 36, 37 million people living with HIV. 45% of those people don't have access to treatment, let alone being worried about getting into the U.S. and how expensive it is. So I need to ask, you know, we also need to ask, why do we need these big conferences? Can we think about different formats for facilitating information exchange, deliberation of science, and elevating advocacy agendas? I think there are models for that, and we just need to put our heads to that.
But didn't you kind of answer that question earlier when you talked about your organization's origin story? It would not exist in its current form were it not for one of these massive international convenings.
Absolutely, but they've gone a lot bigger since then, and at that time it was a different moment in the response to global HIV. So I think we have a lot of knowledge. We know what we need to do. I think we don't have a lot of political will to do what we need to do, right? The fact that so many people are left without treatment when they need treatment is an example of the work that we have to do. And we know what we have to do. We know we have to kind of be working on eliminating barriers. But you know, I'm not sure that these big international conferences get us there. There are other things that we can be doing to mobilize community, and there are other ways to facilitate that kind of exchange.
And just a couple of things I would add. San Francisco is actually the least Black large city in the United States, you know, as a consequence of gentrification and other things. So again, it's just like not the right location for this conference. The conference registration fee is somewhere around $800 or $1,000 for high-income countries. So that alone presents a tremendous barrier to people being able to access this space. But also, I think, you know, in terms of the folks who are supporting this conference coming here, there's some misinformation being spread that it's not completely accurate. So for example, you know, some people are saying that politicians from California have promised to reduce barriers to access, like issues around granting visas to people from other countries, especially people who use drugs and sex workers. That is not possible for members of Congress to do. It is not possible for local politicians to do. We actually tried to work with the Obama administration to remove those barriers in 2012. At that time, I was serving on the President's Advisory Council on HIV and AIDS, along with other folks who were trying to work to remove these exact same barriers. It wasn't possible in that political climate. I don't know why anybody would imagine that it's actually possible today. And not only that, but we know that actually the Trump administration is paying a lot of attention to California. They're cracking down hard. There have been ICE raids in the Bay Area itself where hundreds of people have been targeted. And so what is to prevent that kind of situation from, you know, being even worse during an election year, a presidential election year, where we know there may be a lot of focus on California and sort of like tamping down on, especially on some of the more progressive policies that folks are trying to move.
What's your specific ask? Call off the conference, move the conference, chop it around again?
So there are many global groups that think the conference maybe doesn't need to happen as frequently as every 2 years. It's a big resource strain on organizations to try to get to this conference every 2 years, have a presence there, ensure that our communities are represented there. So, you know, perhaps it could be moved to less frequently. For the purposes of AIDS 2020, our demand is simple. Move it to a lower middle income country that has less travel restrictions. Move it outside the U.S. to the global south. We also have had several conferences in the global north over the last decade or so. And so they're actually, for reasons of parity and access, it really shouldn't be here again so soon.
The second argument I've seen in support of keeping the International AIDS Conference in San Francisco in 2020 is that it's a way of building more political momentum in the United States and putting more pressure on Washington to step up its role fighting HIV both here and abroad. What's your response to that?
First of all, we have to look at the outcomes of the 2012 International AIDS Conference, which gives us a little bit of a recent historical perspective, right? So many organizations within the U.S. spent a couple of years organizing towards that conference in order to specifically uplift and change some policies. And I don't think that we saw a lot of impact or results from that. We were lucky to have an administration that was already committed to addressing the domestic and the global HIV epidemic. We didn't see any significant increase in political will from Congress or any significant, you know, increases in funding for the domestic or global epidemic, any real policy changes. So I think that that question really needs to be asked. What are the goals, especially when California itself is seen as such an outlier in Washington, D.C.?
Right. And I would say that the conferences generally don't yield those kinds of immediate policy impacts. And those issues are already being worked on, and there are people organized around the particular issues of concern. And the conferences are platforms to really shine a spotlight on those issues, but they don't really yield any significant policy shifts or impact. Certainly, one of the things that I'm interested in, if it indeed comes to the Bay Area, is to use the opportunity to highlight the serious disparities that exist between San Francisco and Oakland and Alameda County more generally. And I'm unclear about whether local activists and even activists in the United States will use the conference to talk about the domestic disparities that exist, let alone the disparities that continue to exist globally.
And I think the other piece is we don't need a conference to do that. So we have people with HIV and the communities most impacted by the epidemic here in the U.S. are literally fighting for our lives right now. We're fighting against Medicaid work requirements. We're trying to preserve Medicaid. There's another attack on the Affordable Care Act that impacts all of us because this is about attacks, you know, potentially taking away health care from people with pre-existing conditions. And so we just saw FOSTA and SESTA pass here in the U.S., which directly targeted the sex worker community in the U.S. to the point where the Desiree Alliance, which is a national organization that works on sex worker rights, had to cancel their domestic conference because it's not safe for them to gather. So these issues are already very real. They're already being worked on daily by advocates domestically. And having a conference is just a distraction during a critical election year when there is so much on the line at the state level and the federal. federal level.
And as you said earlier, a resource suck, really. Community-based organizations working these issues don't have the money. They don't have the people power to then devote to these big international AIDS conferences. And at the global level, our movements are really about decriminalizing homosexuality and drug use and sex work as strategies for increasing access to critical services in the HIV world. And those issues are rarely elevated. Significant policy impacts rarely emerge from these big international AIDS conferences on those issues.
So let's take a minute to talk about what the Trump administration has done and might do on HIV policy. We talked about the theoretical possibility that it would reinstate a travel ban on people with HIV entering the country. But that's a hypothetical. He's been in office for a year and a half. Have there been any major moves on HIV policy yet?
I don't see it. I think the moves that we're seeing are more congressional than anything else, and even those are a fight. I think the Senate are a little bit more friendly in supporting the global response to HIV because they understand why it's important to the interests of the U.S. For the Trump administration, they've been kind of silent, and they've been really quite hostile on other issues related to HIV, including sexual and reproductive health and rights of women, which have a ripple effect to sex workers, to transgender people, to gay men who receive their services from, you know, family planning clinics that are dependent on funding from the U.S.
Yeah, I would say that this administration has not turned its focus explicitly to HIV yet, but it has directly targeted repression of the communities most impacted by the epidemic. And so through things like the religious freedom exemptions, which are directly targeting healthcare and services and the right to access essential needs for LGBTQ communities, women's sexual and reproductive health and rights, of course, the consistent attacks on healthcare, the focus on adding work requirements to programs like Medicaid, potentially SNAP. You know, the Farm Bill is actually being debated at the present moment. So these are all direct attacks on people living with HIV and the communities most impacted by the epidemic that the administration is taking on. The fact that they haven't turned their attention specifically to HIV might actually be a good thing.
Well, what significance did you read into the fact that President Trump basically dismantled the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV and AIDS?
So we actually had a number of members serving on that Presidential Advisory Council last year. They publicly resigned in protest of the administration's policies, and particularly the administration's commitment to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. So that was a principled stance that was taken by many different advocates, including a lot of people living with HIV. And the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS allegedly will be reinstated. So there was a nomination process opened earlier this year. That council has not been announced yet. We are keeping a very close eye on who might be named to that council. We have a lot of concern about the types of ideology that might be present on any advisory body that is set up by this administration.
And just to kind of underscore a point Nana was making, you know, the affronts that LGBTI communities are facing, that women's health movements are facing, that sex worker movements are facing should be viewed as an affront to the HIV community. Mm-hmm. And the fact that people are saying that, oh, you know, the Trump administration has been silent, they've been okay on HIV, is really wrong. And so I think it's really quite important for us to keep raising these issues in front of the public's view, and with the understanding that these communities are the communities most impacted by the HIV epidemic.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have. I want to thank both of you for joining us. You just heard the voice of George Ayala. He's executive director of MPACT, Global Action for Gay Men's Health and Rights. Also with us in studio, Nana Khanna. She's executive director of Positive Women's Network. Thank you to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
And that takes us to 8 o'clock in the morning here at KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley. KPFA